This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
You're listening to Stylefile, where we cover everything and anything on the business of fashion. I'm Azura Rahman, and for this week's Style Maker, we have Frankie Turner, the founder of bag label Frankitas.
We want to create something that's a little bit more meaningful than a fashion brand. There's a little bit more to it. There's a story to it, and we want people to understand the story.
After that, Lee Chulin and I will be going over what's made headlines in the fashion industry.
Just like shopping in Singapore on the weekends can be an unpleasant experience, so to Malaysia, so to Kuala Lumpur. I don't think we're far off from people just going, you know what, I'm not going to go out there and fight with 10,000 of my neighbours, you know, just to get into H&M.
And finally, Emma Chong Johnson of Elle Malaysia gets all hung up with the trend for feathers.
The right kind of feathers are easier to wear than, like, you know, a faux fur piece. Because feathers also mostly come in the trim of things. So you can have a normal top, which is just trimmed with feathers.
First up, though, our style maker for this week, Frankie Turner of Frankitas. The art of weaving textile is a traditionally refined skill that is nurtured amongst many generations of Asian families. Oftentimes, such age-old methods are lost within busy metropolitan areas such as Kuala Lumpur. But continuously embracing traditional culture despite her city lifestyle is Frankie Turner, the founder of Frankitas. Originating from a humble village in Bogor, Indonesia, Frankie established the brand in 2014 as a result of her passion for ethnic handicrafts and her Indonesian heritage. As of November 2016, the label's handmade fabrics are incorporated into clutches, bags, jewellery, and even home decor, all created to reintroduce heritage to the modern world and making Frankitas a label that represents something more than just fashion and seasonal trends. Adeline Chung caught up with Frankie as she shared more about the background of her brand and its artisans working behind the scenes.
Now, you've worked in several different industries before Frankitas came along. How did you decide to get involved in fashion?
I think I've always been very passionate about fashion, but it took a long time for me to get here. It took, you know, 4 different jobs and 3 children later. I just wanted to quit the corporate world. You know, I think when you become a mom, you come to a certain age where you just... you rethink, right, about your life, and you think, what do you want to do? You shift your priorities. And my priority are my children. And I wanted to do something. I wanted to create a business. I wanted to create a fashion brand where I could have the power of my own time. So after the 3 kids born and my youngest, she was a little bit more independent, I decided it was time for me to kind of kickstart my career again.
Your own business.
My own business, you know, and pursue my passion for fashion, specifically in something very, very different and something that hasn't really been seen, especially here. I'm very passionate about traditional textile, especially textile with history and heritage. And because I grew up in Indonesia in a small village in Bogor, you know, you grow up with traditional textiles such as batik, songket, as well as ikat.
So it's in your blood, you know, and you like it.
It's in my blood, yeah.
So how did the name Frankitas stem from?
Frankie being my nickname. Mm-hmm. I've been called that since I was a little girl. Tas means bag in Bahasa Indonesia.
Oh.
So hence Frankitas.
Okay, then tell our listeners, you know, what the brand is all about.
We're a little bit quirky. I'm a little bit strange and I'm a bit nuts. So I think the brand is a little
bit... in a good way?
Yeah, I'd like to think so. I hope so. So Frankitas is essentially about the textile. Mm. And it's really the people behind the textiles. And they are our heroes, being the weavers and the makers of the textiles that we use. I wouldn't say that we are a fashion brand. I think we're a little bit more than that. We want to create something that's a little bit more meaningful than a fashion brand. There's a little bit more to it. There's a story to it. And we want people to understand the story. And we want people to understand where the textile comes from and who it's made by and the processes and the technique that's been used, you know, to make the textiles. Because they could take up between 15 to over a month to make for just one loom.
Just one loom?
Yeah. So everything we do is 100% handmade, from the weaving process into the bag making process. The ikat that we use, which is the main textile that we use a lot in Frankitas. They come from Uzbekistan, and the technique that they use is still very, very authentic. It's still very, very traditional.
I assume it's quite tedious because the designs that you have is multicolors.
Extremely,
and, yeah,
yes.
And you have so many, many bags and so many designs. So how big is your team?
I'm pretty much a one-woman show, and then I have an assistant that mm-hmm. helps me out with the administrative bit, and I have a production manager who was actually my business partner and a very mm-hmm. good friend of mine. So she's helping me out in terms of putting some structure and putting some planning into production and into the business, something that I'm still learning to do as a businesswoman and as a brand owner.
But what about the designs? Who does it?
I do all of that. So I'm in charge of the design. I'm in charge of the picking of the fabrics and communicating with the weavers and communicating with the bag makers. I pretty much do 80% of the work. I do the marketing and I do the branding. I do the photography and the styling of all of our photos on Instagram and Facebook.
And you mentioned that you've got weavers to help you out, you know. But who are these people?
So the weavers come from all over, predominantly from Uzbekistan, because we use a lot of Uzbekistan ikat. But we also have weavers in Indonesia, in Bali, as well as Lombok, as well as West Java, where I come from. So we use Uzbekistan ikat a lot because of the traditional method that they use in this modern and industrialized world we live in. Ikat actually originated from Indonesia, mm-hmm. and hence, when I first started Frankitas, I used only Indonesian ikat because I'm biased. Something I grew up with, and my Indonesian blood is very kental, as they say, very thick. But then in discovering a little bit more about textile and doing a lot more research, Uzbekistan actually has the best ikat in the world, in my opinion.
So you have weavers from different countries. I assume you import these
yes.
fabrics and designs back to Kuala Lumpur?
Yes, we do.
And how long does it take for them to get something done? Because you have your designs when you send it over. What's the process like?
The moment we start weaving, as I said, it could take between 15 to 30 days to weave one loom. And then to get that posted here will take another week to 10 days. And then I do the cutting here in our gallery. And then we send it to our bag makers. We have bag makers here in KL, and we have bag makers in Indonesia and in India. Ideally, I'd like to centralize all of our production and do it predominantly or almost 100% in KL. But at the moment, that's not possible because we don't have the skills to make all the different types of bags that we provide.
Mm-hmm.
And then they send it back to us. So there's a lot of...
A lot. Yeah, it's quite tedious.
It is. Logistically, it's a bit of a nightmare. Hence why I want to centralize everything here. And hopefully we can train a lot more people to have the skills to make all the different bags.
So how many bags do you design? And how long does it take for you to design something? Do you have to plan way in advance? Because once your bags are sold out, which yeah. I saw on your website... Yeah. How long does it take for it to replenish, or do you have a different collection, or are they limited?
Well, we try to plan in advance. We don't make very many pieces of each design just because everything is by hand, so we're limited. But then Tangs came over and contacted us and said, listen, we want your stuff at Tangs. And that's when I thought, oh my God, how do I provide them with the quantity that they need? So last year was a huge, huge sort of curving stone for us. I had to really just pump up production. That was really, really difficult. We managed to have a certain quantity. I mean, it wasn't the full quantity that they wanted initially, which they understood. So we did it in batches. But in the end, we finally gave them the quantity that they required. So coming back to your question... Yes, there is a lot of planning involved.
Now, your bags are all handmade, which requires a lot of time, care and effort, you know, during the manufacturing process and all. So how do you decide on making the price point affordable?
Right. So having a fashion business prior to Frankitas, we did a lot of research, again, in terms of pricing, you know, cost price against retail, against wholesale prices. So we normally try to do it times three. So we tried to do the same thing with Frankitas. In terms of pricing, yes, we're more dear than a manufactured bag or clutch. But I think in terms of what we're providing the customers, I think we're priced very fairly. I want Frankitas to be accessible to people. We don't take a huge profit margin because the prices, some of those margins go back to us assisting in the people that we hire and the people that we work with.
Mm-hmm.
We work very closely with single mothers. We work with women that are, you know, financially at a disadvantage. So we try to be fair in our pricing.
Now, you have so many clutches, you've designed so many. Now, what is your favorite piece of product, you know, from the brand that you're most proud of and, you know, think that, you know, would best represent Frankitas?
I think it would have to be our signature Titin clutch, just because of the story behind the Titin clutch. It's a standard clutch, but the bag maker is Titin, hence why we call it the Titin clutch, and she's my aunt. She's come from Indonesia and she lives here now with her Malaysian husband. And, you know, they're not as privileged as we are. So she makes those bags for, you know, their bread and butter. Without that, they would be at a disadvantage. And the fact that she is my aunt and the fact that she makes the bags for me is really special. And the fact that she's my only family here, that makes it special.
Now, you started out the brand with just bags, you know, mm-hmm. but then you branched out into jewelry and then home decorations as well.
Yeah.
So what motivated you to incorporate these ethnic fabrics into, you know, other items as well?
For the simple reason, I wanted to decorate my house. And
that's
it was as selfish and as simple as that. I wanted nice, colorful cushion covers.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted lampshades. And I didn't have those, and I couldn't find anything in Malaysia that suited my taste.
So just do it yourself.
So just do it yourself, lah, you know? So I thought, let's do this, you know? So I started making it for my house.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, friends come over and they tell you, I really like this. And, you know,
I like it as well. Looking at on your website, like, it's very simple designs. But I mean, where do you find inspirations to design bags as well as, you know, for home stuff and jewelries as well?
I'm inspired by a lot of different things, as basic and as simple as, you know, looking at my two girls when they play dress up. From watching a documentary on the sea life. I'm inspired by those things and they give me ideas. Like, I saw a documentary recently and I was thinking, oh, I want to do something on the sea life, you know, and translate that into batik.
Mm.
That's one of the things I'm planning to do, is to make our own batik inspired by the sea life and inspired by nature. Because Bogor, the place I grew up, was an agriculture hub. We were farmers as well. I was surrounded by a lot of greenery. So now a lot of my inspiration comes from flowers and nature in general.
Now, so what's next for Frankitas? You know, are there any upcoming projects, you know, you'll be working on with?
Yes, we're all about collaborating.
Mm-hmm.
With
who? Can you tell?
Not yet.
Okay, when can we expect?
Definitely first quarter of next year. You'll see some collaborations.
Drop some hints, like, you know, someone in KL?
Yes, somebody in Malaysia, and then hopefully somebody outside of Malaysia as well. So that's one. We're also looking into men accessories.
Okay.
So we're looking at ties, bow ties. We're looking at handkerchiefs and those things. I want to kind of cater and provide that to the metrosexuals and to the, you know, the very masculine guys. Well, all types, really.
Noted that the colors are quite vibrant as well.
Yeah,
right?
Well,
and not everyone can accept those colors.
No, so we have to be very, very sensitive. Mm-hmm. We will be very sensitive to the colors that we choose. So it will not be like the Frankitas women line where, you know, we play with a lot of colors. And I think in terms of colors, we have to be a little bit more sensitive and more careful with the men because we don't want to kind of like scare them away. You know?
What about women's wear for perhaps maybe clothing line? Any plans?
Yes, next year, but probably by summer.
Okay.
But again, I don't think it will be our main focus. Our main focus will always be
the bags
and the accessories. I think the apparels would be sort of project basis. It's kind of fun, you know. Yeah.
Now, finally, any words of advice to fellow Malaysians on how else we can preserve our heritage and culture?
Well, wear a piece of that in terms of fashion. I mean, I love batik and, you know, I love the kebaya. I love the Indonesian and the Malaysian kebaya. And I wish people would wear it more. You know, in Indonesia, we wear it all the time. You know, we wear it out. I think there is now a shift in terms of the fashion movement here in Malaysia. I think people are becoming more conscious and becoming aware of the heritage, which I'm so happy to see. I'm so, so happy that a lot more people are, you know, blogging and taking photos with their baju kurung, with their songket and their kebaya. I think it's improving, but I think we can do better. I mean, you have other designers here in Malaysia that are doing special, special stuff on heritage. You know, you've got Adila Long doing a lot of songket and it's stunning, you know.
Songket clutches and all, yeah.
Songket clutches as well as bajus and they're beautiful. And I think we need to have a little bit more of that so that the general public will start wearing that. So heritage can be worn and can be modern and can be contemporary and can be in style.
Coming up next, Lee Chui Lin and I will be going over the latest news in the fashion industry. But before that, here's Chairlift with Sidewalk Safari, played at Charlotte Ronson's Fall 2016 collection in New York. This is Style File on BFM 89.9, bringing fashion to you over the airwaves. I'm Azura Rahman, and it's time for Style Scoop with Lee Chui Lin. This week, to sum it up, Lin, it's milk, shopping, and boobs.
Very nice.
Very nice.
Very nice. So many interests.
So many interesting points of view there. But first up, though, Milk, the makeup brand that literally started with nothing. And this was a special piece on BOF, businessoffashion.com. And I think there are a lot of lessons to be learned from this story about a hip, cool makeup brand that was founded by a photography studio in LA that had zero expertise in cosmetics, but a whole lot of branding and marketing now. So I don't know if you've seen Milk makeup on Instagram, but, you know, somehow it has flooded my discovery feed, which kind of says a lot about me, I suppose, you know. But basically, it's a cool range of makeup products and, you know, minimalist white packaging. And I've been very curious about it. And now I finally come across a story. Basically, Milk Studios is a famed fashion photography studio in LA. And they had ventured into Made Fashion Week, a showcase for emerging designers that co-founded by the studios, which launched the careers of Alexander Wang, Proenza Schooler, Joseph Altuzarra. Basically, they are the creators of cool in some ways within LA fashion lore. And they wanted to create a product and they created Milk Cosmetics. And that was it, basically. And they went for a pitch to Sephora.
With no products.
With no product, but just concepts. And they won them over. So this has kind of blown my head because, you know, in the sense that their philosophy is not to copy what their competitors' bestsellers are. So, you know, they're not going to come up with the greatest serum because that seems to be the skincare product to have. Or, you know, the greatest highlighter because, you know, highlighting and contouring and strobing is the in thing. They completely started from zero in terms of not only product but also knowledge and came up with crazy products like a solid cooling moisturizer, a blush oil, you know, and silver antimicrobial packaging, you know. So it's really innovative stuff.
There is a part of me that when I read the article had a gut negative reaction to how dare you come into this space and know nothing. And this is speaking as somebody who likes my fair share of cosmetics.
You do?
And I like to keep up to date with the things that are happening because I just find it such an interesting space. And there was, I admit it, there was a part of me that was like, how dare you come in here? And then I read a little bit more about what they were doing and how they were approaching it. And I think there are benefits to coming in knowing nothing, because then you're not trying to copy Maybelline's Great Lash, you know, yeah. which everybody tells you you should have. You're not trying to copy the best under eye concealer, you know, Giorgio Armani's foundations. You're not trying to copy those sorts of things. You're just saying, well, what does my customer want to use? And starting from there, and in a way, isn't that how everybody should function?
That's the other thing. They didn't collaborate or work with the big brands, like, you know, your L'Oreal that owns Maybelline's and, you know, Giorgio Armani Cosmetics, whatever it is. They decided to really go on their own so that they could have full control, creative control over their makeup line. So I'm sure their indignation turned to admiration very quickly in that sense, right?
It did, it did. Once I realized that they were still attempting to use high quality ingredients, that they were still thinking about pigmentation, about how long things would last, all things that are very important to me, that's when I thought, okay, no, I understand now that you came from nothing, but you're not venturing out towards equally nothing. You know, you had this idea. And I like also that it's not the ideal girl. It's the ideal boy or the ideal girl.
It's gender neutral.
Exactly. And so you have this idea of this cool kid out there and the idea of what makeup they want to put on their face. And then you just make that makeup. And that's kind of what everybody who's ever liked makeup wanted to do at one point. You just sat down and thought, you know what? Everything I own sucks. I just wish that I could craft this one perfect thing that would be ideal for me to use and maybe other people like me.
And then came the numbers. I mean, they launched in March this year in 50 Sephora stores in the US. And in just 6 months, they expanded to 100 Sephora stores as well as 50 Urban Outfitters. I mean, like, that's crazy, you know, for a fledgling makeup brand. I can't help but compare to another favorite of ours, Glossier, which was, of course, founded by Emily Weiss, who is behind Into the Gloss, the makeup blog. They're still struggling with shipping internationally. I guess they have not spoken to the big boys. They're doing things very differently. And I can't help but feel impressed that, you know, makeup brands that used to be associated with the big old guards, like, you know, your Lancome's, your Estee Lauder, your MAC, can really come up from passion. And you see that more locally as well. I've seen so many long-lasting lip creams that's been launched by this fashion designer, by this makeup artist, by, you know, society girls. It's something that's quite possible nowadays to launch your own makeup brand.
I'm also looking at the price point right now on the website, and it seems to sit at about the Glossier mark, you know, at about $16 to $20 for the lip products anyway. And I think there's something to be said about that comparison to Glossier. And I agree that it's becoming more interesting and more possible to launch your own makeup brand. But on that Glossier comparison, there's also the fact that Glossier often seems to put out their own sort of rebuttals to trends, if that makes sense. So they're not necessarily trying to trend set. They're saying, okay, look, so everybody else has come up with all their matte lipsticks. Here's ours. Everyone's come up with all the highlighters. Here's why ours is the best. And Milk comes from a completely different perspective and aesthetic. It's like, no, no, no. I don't care that this is the traditional way to make a lip stain. This is how I'm going to make mine. And there's something to be admired about both. And I think I would love to support Milk. I'm interested in finding out more about them, especially after finding out about their business practices.
I think more than anything else, the lessons that can be gleaned from this success story, just 6 months, imagine, is that innovation, marketing, and one more, Instagrammability is key to the success of whether you're a fashion brand, whether you're a makeup brand. Any fledgling labels out there, these are the things that you really need to look out for to make it, I suppose. And for our second story for this week, Singapore shoppers go online and malls go offline. I know that's kind of a bad one, but, you know, this is, if you listen to the story, Lynn, you get a better understanding. But basically, AsiaOne.com has highlighted how if you were to walk into any shopping mall in Singapore today, chances are you will be greeted by empty or boarded up shop spaces. Bloomberg ran a report recently where they obtained some facts and figures from the Urban Redevelopment Authority about the overall retail outlook in Singapore. And they highlighted that vacancies found in shopping malls today are at their lowest since 2006, even though rental rates have declined. And they put it down to two things. Basically, of course, you know, the world economy is kind of shrinking at the moment, so not everyone's spending as much as they used to. Consumer spending has gone down. But also the Singaporeans' preference for online shopping. Now, I looked through the gallery of photos on this piece, Lynn, and it was a sorry state of affairs because you've got shopping malls on Orchard Road, like Orchard Central and Far East Plaza, and malls in Marina Bay with boarded up shops. And you just wouldn't think in a city as glittering and as fast-paced and as cosmopolitan as Singapore is, that they would be blighted by empty shops in malls.
I think it's also a reaction to the state of Singapore itself, though. I mean, when you were talking earlier about Singapore glittering, true, all these things are true. Something else also true, Orchard Road is unpleasant to walk on weekends. It just is. I'm sorry, but it is. And I think everybody who's been there knows it. And the idea of jostling for an item that you want versus getting it delivered to your doorstep, especially when you have an efficient e-marketing system and shipping system, it just makes perfect sense. Honestly, if I lived in Singapore, I might do that more often as opposed to here where you still have your little mix-ups and your little, sorry, we're sending it in a while, and you know, little things like that. I imagine that Singapore's got their e-commerce completely figured out.
You make it sound also as though shopping is an outdated experience altogether in that sense.
Yes and no.
Antiquated, quaint kind of thing to do.
There is a part of me that will always like window shopping, that will always like walking into a shop and touching things, feeling the hems, actually looking at something. But I think speaking as somebody who lives in Malaysia, for whom many of the more interesting independent brands, you know, they haven't really arrived yet. I mean, look at how excited we all were about Isetan.
Yes.
Yeah, and that's because it gives us an opportunity to get to brands that previously would only have been available to us online. So I think as somebody who would like to wear interesting clothes by independent brands sometimes, you get used to shopping online and you get used to kind of getting those needs met online. And so when I read this, I was like, yeah, I mean,
it makes sense, right? And Singapore, I really feel in some ways, it's a microcosm of the bigger world out there. I think we've got so many news feeds saying about how so many malls in America are closing down. You know, obviously, Amazon killed a lot of retailers out there. And I see that happening here at some point, really, you know, where people, you know, go to malls just to eat, for example, or to get other needs met as opposed to actually shopping. And although, you know, the saturation of online shopping is not as great as how it is in Singapore and Malaysia, it is something that's building up. And you see the amount of fashion portals that have done very well, Fashion Valley and Zalora in Malaysia, for example. I think we are headed in that direction. We do have malls that have shuttered in KL itself. SS2 Mall is a great example.
Well, yes.
Which is being completely redeveloped. And I think we'll see more of that happening, perhaps, you know?
We're at oversaturation, I think. And again, just like shopping in Singapore on the weekends can be an unpleasant experience, so to Malaysia, so to Kuala Lumpur. I don't think we're far off from people just going, you know what? No, I'm not going to go out there and fight with 10,000 of my neighbours, you know, just to get into H&M. Yes. I'm just going to do this online.
I'm doing that anyway. I'm doing most of my shopping
online. You see?
I know. Sorry, retailers. Anyway, for our final story for this week, boobs are over. I said it, you know. Well, not me, actually. Vogue said it, as a matter of fact. And they asked in their latest issue, whatever happened to the cleavage? Can body parts become a fashion item? We'll discuss that in a bit more. But basically, you know, they are saying with it labels like Gucci favouring high neck blouses or shirts that just display the collarbone, the boobs up to your chin look, something I've never been able to achieve, by the way.
Me too.
It's completely dead. There is a comeback for the soft, natural 70s boobs. That's how it was said in the article, not my words. Free from padding and underwiring. And even bra manufacturers are seeing triangle soft bras making a comeback. And Net-a-Porter, for example, has seen a third of its sales dedicated to wireless bras.
I think we had this conversation when we last spoke about the rise of the bralette as well. I think this is true for people who are... It sounds as if it's a move towards body positivity, right? Towards away from, you know, hoisting up the girls.
Hiking them up.
Exactly. But I think the truth of the matter is that it's still not any closer to that, because in order to go braless, or in order to go without wires, or in order to go just in these sorts of light, soft bras... Not everybody can do that for various reasons.
Yes, you need to be of a certain, you know, body type at the end of the day. I mean, like, of a certain age, I would even go and say that. You know?
I think that for the larger endowed amongst us, these trends just sound so exclusive in the sense of excluding them, not exclusive in a good way, just in the sense that, well, I can't participate in that. So all your dresses cut down to the navel that don't provide any room for any sort of support exclude me. I just cannot wear that. And I'm not counting myself amongst them. I, like you, have never been able to achieve the sort of scaffolded look. So I'm glad it's gone. But
nothing to scaffold.
Then again, it never really impacted me because I could never really do that anyway.
Do you agree, though, with Vogue's assertion that, you know, basically body parts can be in and out of fashion? Because I do to a certain extent, because real things back to around 6-7 years ago.
Michelle Obama's arms even, and yes, how that started off a whole thing. Yeah.
Same with legs. Everyone was in miniskirts. When was the last time you've seen someone in miniskirt? You know, basically it's just fashions change and, you know, and hence erogenous zones change in fashion as well. So, you know, what was all about thigh and leg 5-6 years ago, and you see maxi skirts and midi skirts becoming the norm now, you know, and it's the same with cleavage, I suppose. And, you know, now there is a whole fetishization of the abs, for example, and the ab crack, you know. Things do move in and out of fashion. Same with body parts, I suppose.
Agreed. And I think this sounds like a friendly move, but we have to admit that just like any other trend, just like any other fetishization of anything, it isn't really, because it still idealizes something that not everybody has.
Absolutely. I mean, you think maxi skirts are all-inclusive? What if you have fat ankles?
What if you're just the wrong shape? I mean, you might not have a small waist. It might not be the best look for you.
You might be 4 feet nothing.
All these things are true,
Azura.
All
these things, you know, so...
And we're representing all these women on air today. Thank you for that.
After the break, we have Emma Chong Johnston, Managing Editor of Elle Malaysia, breaking down the trend for feathers. It's Azura Rahman on Style File. And next up, we have Emma Chong Johnston of Elle Malaysia getting down with this season's trend for feathers. For this season, feathers. Sounds like a very feminine kind of trend, a very frou-frou kind of trend.
Yeah, very romantic.
Very romantic, yes.
So this is like the flip side to all the kind of more modern, sporty trends we've been speaking about recently. And also, the season on the runways was filled with this kind of stuff. So very like maximal things. So lots of sequins, lots of embellishment, feathers, trims, faux fur, lace. And feathers, I think, is kind of a very easy entry point to the look. The right kind of feathers are easier to wear than, like, you know, a faux fur piece. Because feathers also mostly come in the trim of things. So you can have a normal top, which is just trimmed with feathers.
The right kind of feathers. What kind of feathers are we looking at?
So mainly what we've been seeing are the very kind of soft and wispy, very downy feathers.
Ostrich.
Yeah. But obviously in quite delicate trim. So it's not a full-on like feather can-can tutu kind of skirt. It comes in the trims of things or on shoes and accessories, on a clutch. A feathery clutch is a very, very nice thing to have. So yeah, it's a very soft look.
So it's more of an accent as opposed to a full-on, like you said, feather skirt or feather dress in that sense. And the thing is about feathers, there's always the danger of buying something that looks a bit stringy or not lush as how it's meant to look, right? So what you're looking for, you need to look for something that's quite full, I suppose.
Yeah, and also because especially if you're going to be buying from the high street, you need to bear in mind that a lot of it will probably fall off. So try and get the fullest one you can.
The more you pay, the better quality you get in that sense for this anyway. Is it a one season trend though? Is it something worthy to actually invest in considering how expensive feathers can be?
Yeah, it's true. I think faux fur has a lot more longevity than feathers, both in the sense of the trend and in the actual practical sense in that it will stick around for longer and it's easier to take care of. So yeah, this is kind of just like a fun thing to add to your wardrobe this season. I don't think it's necessarily something that's going to be a lifetime staple. Having said that, feathers do come back into fashion. You know, it's all part of that cycle. So if you do find a really amazing like feathered clutch or something that you love, then yeah, by all means.
Are we looking at autumnal colours though?
No, actually. There's a lot of black feathers, but that is a little bit, you know...
Maleficent-like.
Yeah, a little bit black swan. And so a lot of the feathers have been in very light, so whites and dove greys and lilacs and very kind of powdery pastel colours.
Right, okay. Anything that you're particularly inspired by? Any, you know, must-have piece that you think that everyone should consider?
I really think kind of like a feather-trimmed t-shirt, and there are a lot of these around, so just feather trimming around the hem is quite a nice segue into the trend. Without kind of going full on feathers. But other than that, you know, feathery shoes are so pretty. You know, I think feathery shoes is a good one to go for.
Just don't wear them in the rain.
Yes, no.
And that was this week's episode of Style File. If you've missed any parts of the show, catch up with our podcast on www.bfm.my/stylefile. And don't forget to like our Facebook page, Style File on BFM 89.9. Before we go, though, we leave you with Aeroplane with Without Lies. And this was played at Millie's Fall 2016 collection in New York. This has been Style File with Azura Rahman on BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.